Hey, welcome back. George Norrie is coming to Salt Lake City Saturday, March the 10th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Gene Wagner Theater. And you can enjoy watching George interview ancient technology expert Jason Martell, UFO investigator and journalist Nick Pope, and the man who died three times and lived to tell about it, Danyon Brinkley. George, of course, will sing a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in a Q&A with each and every guest. Don't miss out. Tickets are going to go fast. Call the box office at 801-355-2787. 801-355-2787. Or visit artsaltlake.org for tickets. artsaltlake.org. Hey, if you like what you're hearing tonight, this morning, why not check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. It airs out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio and on 36 affiliates across North America. You can listen anywhere in the world on my free app, The Conspiracy Show. And don't forget my new podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Subscribe at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. More of my conversation with Theodore Roosevelt Malick, the author of Davos, Aspen, and Yale, My Life Behind the Elite Curtain as a Global Sherpa. We'll also take phone calls, questions, and comments at the bottom of the hour. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Theodore Roosevelt Malick, author of Davos, Aspen, and Yale, My Life Behind the Elite Curtain as a Global Sherpa. We were talking about CIA, the FBI, the Justice Department, the FBI, another black eye after this horrific shooting in Parkland, Florida. Someone there may have, or it appears, dropped the ball. How many more black eyes can the FBI suffer? We seem to be approaching a point of a confidence crisis in these agencies. How do we get it back? How do we correct this situation?
Are you asking me that question?
Yes. Sorry, Theodore. Yes.
Well, I mean, there's no question that we need policing agencies, we need intelligence agencies, but we need them to be competent in the first instance. We need them to be fair and unprejudiced, and most of all, we need them to refrain from politicization. I mean, they're not supposed to be political operations, and it seems like, at least in recent times, they've become more and more polluted with political ramifications. So could we do with smaller agencies, coordinate the effort, and probably get rid of a lot of people? I think that will probably be the outcome.
Another thing that's received a black eye, it seems of late, at least in the eyes of millennials, is capitalism itself. There was a poll recently, the annual report on U.S. attitudes towards socialism, and it found that the majority of millennials would prefer to live in a socialist, communist, or fascist nation rather than a capitalistic one. Now, the vast majority, 42%, said they would, the vast majority, 44%, would prefer a socio-economic order of socialism than the other seven, I suppose, you know, fascism and so forth. But 58% don't want to live, these are millennials, don't want to live in a capitalist system. How did we get to this point?
Well, having been a party to so many academic institutions where, frankly, they're indoctrinated with socialist ideas, it's not a surprising statistic to me. When they get into the workforce and they mature and they actually see that their paychecks are construed in such a way and that their taxes pay for certain things and that the more income they have, the better life they can live, they usually begin to adapt and change their ways, if not completely. So young people are, on the whole, inclined to be very idealistic, and sometimes that includes stupidly socialistic. But It is problematic, and you saw this even in the presidential campaign in the U.S., where the millennials were quite excited about Bernie Sanders, an independent socialist from Vermont, not all that inclined towards even Hillary Clinton or other campaigns, because they like the idea of free things. But eventually, somebody has to somehow, in some way, pay for those free things. So when they actually get an income and find that they're the ones paying for it, they sometimes have second thoughts.
But you mentioned, this obviously is these students being inculcated with these ideas in colleges and universities. The other trend that we're seeing in colleges and universities used to be they were, bastions of free speech, and students used to march for more free speech, sort of the classical liberal mindset. And now we have these institutions, they seem to have an absolute aversion to free speech. And these cohorts are going to graduate and become newspaper publishers and alder, city councilors and mayors and so forth. To me, I mean, part of this, I mean, it scares me, quite frankly. I see this as potentially an existential threat to Western civilization. Or am I blowing things out of all proportion here?
Well, I mean, we could overstate the problem, but I think you're onto something, and it is a monolithic point of view. We can decry it, we can make fun of it, we can, obviously describe it with all the snowflake language that is used, these safe zones. But eventually you run into people who don't agree with you, and you have to find ways to do business with them. You have to find ways to converse with them, and the world is frankly full of such people. There are ideological differences, there are national differences, there are military differences, cultural differences. They're not going to go away. They're not eradicated. The best way to actually work with people is to hear them, frankly, and to listen to them, have them listen to you, and to have some conversation or dialogue about what you can and can't do together and how you would find ways to work things out. So what frightens me is that, if you have this monolithic point of view and you can't take any countering points of view, then where does that lead to our democratic institutions and our democratic values? That's quite frightening.
Yes, because and it's not just limited to places like Berkeley and so forth. We're seeing this mindset now in large corporations, places like Google, where there seems to be a total lack of ideological diversity. They talk about diversity,
Yeah, no.
but
That's a
certainly.
very good point, one I've made many times, that this notion of diversity, which is so important in cultural life, corporate life, sometimes revolves around gender issues or racial issues, sometimes around ethnicity backgrounds. But we very rarely talk about intellectual diversity. And in my findings, and I write lots of business books and business cases, we find that the best companies, in fact, are trying to find people not just from all these different categories, but who think differently. And in fact, it leads to a better corporation, to a better bottom line. So you want people around you who are contrarian, who challenge your own point of view, who stretch your ideation and bring you into new worlds. And the cultures that are all the same, in fact, underperform. If you had just a culture of engineers, they wouldn't perform. So we have to, in fact, in an investable art sense, have people in these different subject matters, in these different areas and different domains, but we need to bring them together, not just in corporations, but also in our public institutions. That's the true enrichment.
Yeah, it seems like we're heading down this road where having the wrong opinion, well, we're already there in many instances, having the wrong opinion is being criminalized.
Well, it gets to that point, and certainly when you have social media that are now kicking people out because they have opinions or state things in certain ways that are not acceptable to the police of those social media, it's very discouraging. So we have a diminution of First Amendment rights. I personally don't like lots of opinions, and I would love to debate people. I mean, I'm a debater, you can tell by nature. But in order to have those debates, you have to be able to state those points of view. We had one the other day at Oxford University, which is, of course, one of the classic places for political debate, still seemingly quite open to it. They had a debater that had a point of view that was very contrary to, what could you say, the normal liberal point of view. Students didn't agree with it. It was very well stated, and in the interchange, I think both sides learned a great deal. That is the paragon. That is what we should be attempting to do.
Should federal and state monies be withheld from universities and colleges if they fail to uphold First Amendment rights?
Absolutely. I think that we should look at all kinds of federal programs, federal monies, Pell Grants, the universities, and we have universities that are, you know, privately funded or more so, and we have state universities, but all of them are funded to some extent, you know, using tuition monies that benefit from the federal taxpayer or the state taxpayer, and they should have a say in these things. In Europe, they have the debate about whether university education should be free. There are certain places where students have benefited for a long point of time from the taxpayer extravagance of basically paying for the university education ad infinitum. In the U.S. and Canada, we don't have that tradition. People are paying, usually incurring great debt. But they should be going to places where they're learning things, first of all, where they're not indoctrinated, and secondly, where they're free to basically converse about ideas. That is the original meaning, the definition of a university.
Would you say that we are in the midst of a culture war?
There's no question we've been in a culture war, and we are in a culture war. There are people that lament that, that would like to paper it over, but we are, I think, in terms of Western civilization versus other parts of the world, in a culture war, but certainly in North America, between the ideological forces, we are in a culture war, and the shape and form of that culture war certainly heats up and cools down at certain points in time, but we are in a culture war. You see that on television, you see that in various media, you certainly see that in social media, you see it in literature, and it's very much, very much present in the political discourse.
Is there a tipping point, a point at which you're concerned that a culture war could lead to civil war? Is that even
well, it does
worthy
flare
of discussion?
Up into violence at times, and that's of course a great concern when you have a, let's say, a conservative speaker going to a university. We could name the university, and all kinds of Antifa or other far left and anarchist forces come together and try to stop that speech, that set buildings on fire, that do not just protests but physical harm to both physical plant and to persons. It's a violent episode that is that could spill over into the wider society, and then you see that certainly when police are shot in different cities, you see that in different political protests. You've seen it most recently, even I think in some sporting events. So we're close to a tipping point. I'm very hopeful that we could have saner minds, and that we could go back to a better tradition of actually disagreeing with each other. I mean, it goes back some point in time, but during the Abraham Lincoln-Douglas debates, they would have huge crowds for hours on end debating the future of the United States, and particularly the issue of slavery, and no one committed any atrocity or physical violence at those debates. It'd be nice to have such debates again.
I'd like to talk about your time at the U.S. State Department. What was your role there?
I was a young 28, 29-year-old international economist in the Bureau of Intelligence and Research. I had top secret code word clearance. So I read all the intelligence in the U.S. intelligence community, and wrote both speeches and analysis for the Secretary of State. And I had a certain domain that I covered that had to do with East-West and North-South relations, particularly revolving around certain commodities and UN issues. And it, you know, was quite a fascinating time. It was the Cold War.
I know that you've written extensively about U.S. relations with Turkey. What concerns you about Turkey and how the United States is dealing with Turkey at this point.
Well, Turkey is a long-standing U.S. ally. It had a very critical role, of course, on the front line during the Cold War. It has itself become a middle-income country of some size and some significance. It straddles an important, landmass between East and West Europe and Asia. The U.S. has typically had very good and strong relations as a NATO member with Turkey. Those relations have diminished, I think, frankly, quite a bit in the last decade, and they're eroding, and they've been going in the wrong direction. I was encouraged to see Secretary of State Tillerson this week try to mend some of those fences in Ankara, and Turkey wants to be and can and should be still a strong ally of the West. It is a very large Islamic population. It tends to be more secularist than other Islamic countries. But it has an important role to play vis-a-vis the Middle East, certainly in relations with Russia and the Central Asia republics. And I'd just like personally to see the relations between the U.S. and Turkey, or the West and Turkey, improve. They've proven very difficult for any number of reasons.
And the President Trump's handling of North Korea. He has obviously been criticized for using, bellicose language and so forth. How would you grade his handling of the situation in North Korea?
Well, I think I'd withhold the grade until we see what happens, which could be, within the next 6 months. And that's really the time frame we're talking about. He's obviously, and many of us are, sick and tired of a kind of strategic patience. When the country is developing nuclear weapons that could, in fact, be deployed anywhere, frankly, in the world, but certainly towards Guam, towards Japan, towards the West Coast, and maybe even the East Coast of the United States. So the nuclear threat that's presented by the Hermit Kingdom is something to take very seriously. We're going to try to impose more stringent economic sanctions. They typically don't work, or they take a very long time to work. We need a concerted effort. It's not clear that either the Chinese or the Russians are completely on board, although they talk about being more willing. The question is, I think, here, what will we do next? Will we shoot down, a North Korean missile, the next one that goes up? Will we put a blockade on all trade and use our Navy, in fact, to enforce an economic blockade? Will we do some things behind the scenes to try to change the regime in North Korea? I will be keenly, although this is not my own expertise, I'll be keenly watching to see what the Trump administration and the president himself has in mind in the next really very, very short duration, because this is not something that's going to unwind over years, but likely over the next few months.
You're saying we have maybe a six-month window to deal with this problem, or the genie's out of the bottle?
Yes. And for some, I would say, the Davos crowd, they're basically saying, well, they have nuclear weapons, so what? We have to live with it. We basically, have to have relations with North Korea and hope that they don't use them. Well, that's not a degree of trust that President Reagan, or certainly President Trump, I think, would favor. So we're going to do some things. We're going to do more things. And not that I know what they are, but I can guess they're going to be forthcoming in the next few months.
All right. We will open up the phone lines and take questions and comments after the break. Stay with us right here on Coast to Coast AM. Where did the last 4 hours go? I couldn't begin to tell you. We will get to your questions and comments for Theodore Roosevelt Malik in just a few moments. Just want to remind you, there's another George Norrie Alive event coming your way. This one's in Scottsdale, Saturday, April the 21st at the Virginia G. Piper Theater. Again, Saturday, April 21st. in Scottsdale, and you can enjoy watching George interview spirit traveler Sonia Grace, astronomer and master of all things space, Dr. Sky, Steve Cates. And they'll end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology today. Dr. Lynn Katai, Phoenix Lights, of course, Melinda Leslie, and Travis Walton, as well as John D'Souza, the X-Man. George will sing a few songs with the live band. You can take part in a Q&A with each guest. And again, tickets will go fast. They are going fast. So you want to call the box office at 480-499-8587, 480-499-8587, or visit ScottsdalePerformingArts.org, ScottsdalePerformingArts.org. Back with Theodore Roosevelt Malick and your calls when Coast to Coast continues in mere moments. Theodore, you also spent time at the United Nations. What do you see as the U.S.'s role moving forward in the U.N.? There seems to be a trend we're seeing where the U.S. seems to be in a bit of a retreat from the U.N., pulling funding from certain agencies and so forth. How do you see that going moving forward?
Well, I think that will continue, certainly under President Trump. The UN is a problematic institution. It's never lived up to its claim. It's frankly a pretty colossal waste of money. So you're going to see the U.S. not just leaving the UNESCO, but other similar kinds of agencies. The Trump speech at the UN General Assembly last year, I think, is an indication of where we're going. We'll see how Ambassador Haley, our U.S. ambassador, states and handles that. But it seems to me like we need to tell the truth about the U.N., which is not all that it's cranked up to be. It is underdelivered, and frankly, we have to find other ways to do international relations.
All right, let's go to the wildcard line. DJ's in Santa Cruz, California. DJ, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Malick, for coming on Coast. We seldom or never hear from members of the elite, but we talk about the elite much. My question is on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. It buried in the hundreds of thousands of pages, and I'm no expert, let me say that at the beginning. Buried in there was a section giving multinational corporations the ability to sue nation states for lost profits if the laws of the country prevented them from achieving predicted profits. So my question is, how does something like that get into a treaty? Who is behind it? And secondly, it seems that much of the goals of the global elite are accomplished through treaties, often secret, and which are definitely not democratically voted upon. Thank you.
Well, all right, the TPP.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership. And for all the right reasons, some of which were just mentioned. These treaties take years and years to negotiate. They're usually done behind closed doors. All kinds of lobbying groups, sometimes represented, sorted, and multinational interests get their way, and they don't help the normal, everyday, average citizen of the countries that, in fact, are involved.
What do you see as the future of NAFTA? Is Trump's administration going to rip that up?
Well, NAFTA is under great strains, and it has benefited Mexico and to some degree Canada more than the United States. So it is in the throes. Bobby Lighthizer, the American ambassador, the trade representative, is probably in the last innings, if you use the baseball analogy, of the renegotiation. And it will come out looking much more, much different and much more favorable to the U.S. than it has, if it comes out at all. There's a 30% or 40% chance that it won't be ripped up. It just won't be renewed. In which case, both Mexico and Canada will have to have then different economic points of departure for operating in the global economy, and particularly with their key trading partner, the United States. So, this is a period for rethinking trade agreements.
Does Trump prefer bilateral trade agreements rather than these large trading block type deals?
Well, that is just abundantly clear. I mean, one of the first things he did was to say no to the TPP. The TIPS, which is the equivalent in Europe, is going nowhere. It will go nowhere. He's not a multilateralist. Well, and most particularly, going back to an earlier point, he's not a supranationalist. He doesn't believe in supranational organizations. For any number of reasons, one of which is the United States is the largest, strongest power, both politically and militarily, economically in the world, he prefers bilateral relationships, and those could flourish, and I think will flourish during his presidency.
Let's go to the wild card line again. Frank is in Hollywood, Maryland. Frank, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Howdy, Mr. Sarrett. Glad to be back with you. I want to make
Thank
some
you.
Comments and a question. President Trump, I can't figure him out. He's supposed to have 29% of the Hispanic vote. You would think he would put more Hispanics in his administration, in the cabinet. And then he said about President Obama being born somewhere other than the United States. Well, where's your proof? He hasn't presented one iota of proof. He says things off the top of his head. And actually, he told more lies than any president I can think of. Now, getting back to President Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex that he warned us about, well, how come he didn't do anything about it? He certainly didn't do anything for civil rights. And then President Trump, if it wasn't for Gorilla Glue and duct tape and the three generals, the three wise men, this administration would careen down a cavernous corridor to a chaotic climax.
All right, the king of what's the, alliteration there, Frank?
Alliteration.
I appreciate that. Yeah. Yes. Okay, Eisenhower. Good question. I mean, he warned us about the military-industrial complex, but was he behind the scenes? Perhaps was he doing anything about it?
Well, I think it was a warning. I mean, he came from that orbit himself, and I think he saw it exercising too much power. That's why the warning. I don't think much has been done about it since that period. And in fact, we find ourselves in the predicament we find ourselves in presently, where I would argue that there was a conspiracy to depose the duly elected president of the United States, which is what I'm writing about in this new book, A Plot to Destroy the President, where we now know who was behind it, who paid for it, who sponsored it, how the FBI and the CIA ran with it, the anti-Trump cabal at those agencies, which run very high up in the chain of command, how CNN actively fomented it in a fake news, the Trump dossier and all the conclusion loudly, continually, for their own political reasons, and that government employees that we now know, we can name them, were organizing or involved in covertly organizing what is in effect a coup d'etat to overthrow the legitimately elected president, Donald Trump. So this is a very, very, very dangerous period in American history, I would say, much, much more so than Watergate.
Let's go to the first time caller. Eric is in Northridge, California. Eric, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Yeah, gentlemen, thank you for allowing me to join your conversation. I think my question is going to fall perfectly in regards to your guest's last comments right there. And my question is towards Richard's question about the culture war and whether we're past a tipping point. I actually believe that we are past a tipping point. And I believe personally that a great divorce is coming here in the nation. So my question is, what are your thoughts in regards to the use of Article 5 of the U.S. Constitution, specifically in the organization of a convention of states, towards the dissolution of the Union? Of course, it's the most extreme act that could take place in our country. I'd like to point out that no lesser minds at this time are actually proposing this, such as Mark Levin, who's recommending that we use a convention of the states actually to solve our problems, not for a dissolution, I'll point out, could have a convention of the states to solve the problems, but take the country in a more conservative direction, which I don't believe people on the left would accept. What are your thoughts about the actual dissolution of the union?
Well, I don't think we're at the point of civil war yet. I think that there is lots of animosity, obviously, a lot of extreme language and rhetoric that there seem to be, pretty strong polarization. But the political forces do go on. We do have free elections. The Republicans actually control the state houses. They control the Congress. They controlled the Senate, and they have an unusual but a Republican president at present. So the idea that we'd need to exercise what was suggested in Article 5 is probably unlikely. It is there as a possibility. I would like to see the union sustain itself and continue. And I think that, frankly, we will not see diminution of Republican power even during this off-year election, that the Republicans should maybe lose a few seats in the House but maintain control of the Senate. And I personally believe if Trump stays on this trajectory, and particularly the economic performances in the upper quartile, that it continues into the future, that we'll have a two-term president.
All right, Eric, thank you for that. Let's say hi. Let's go west of the Rockies, and Nate is in Seattle, Washington. Good morning, Nate.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I would like to first say thank you in general, but Mr. I forgot your name, I'm sorry, but...
Malik.
Malik, I have... anyway, I have, oh my God, this is crazy. Mr. Malik, I would like to say that I have admired you, but I would like to say that the European Union situation that you were talking about previously on a different show, I believe that I have information about that, but basically the European Union was based on Hitler's plans. But the reason I called tonight, or part of the reason I called tonight, was that I felt like I needed to talk about this ridiculous...
Oh, Nate, I'll tell you what. Why don't we put you on hold and you can sort of gather your thoughts and see if we can get back to you. We're running out of time here, but we'll see. You gather your thoughts. We'll put you on hold and we'll see if we can come back to you in the final few minutes here. In the meantime, let's go east of the Rockies. Tim is in Jacksonville, Florida. Hello, Tim.
Hey, Rich and Ted. Great show, man. Thank you for your service. Hey, I want to talk about the world order. I'm evangelical and, I love conspiracy stuff, but if we think about the Illuminati and their control globally, and again, I don't think they're fully in control. I was in the military; nothing gets implemented fast, speedily. Most things take time, but we've got laws on the books that, we've got laws on the books that are already there. You know, most people aren't aware of, and if they decided to enforce those laws, they could. You know, as a nation, I see us spending ourselves into oblivion, not so much where we're a third world country, but where we'll be equal with other nations. I imagine it is hard to stay humble whenever you're that wealthy. I imagine it's hard to stay humble if you're a congressman, a senator, or a representative, where you're dealing with so much money. It's kind of harder for pride not to get in there, I would imagine. But, I think about the elite, they're full of pride. You know, some of the elites think that they were born with, a right above the common folk. And, we're really a bunch of lemmings. If you look globally, we're a bunch of lemmings. We have countries that are being helped financially with food. they have countries that are in shackles as far as financially. California, I'm from Illinois myself, do a shout out to the St. Louis area, but the economy is just, look at what they did with the oil. They shut the whole oil industry up, and you know, we've got relatively cheap prices. These guys control stuff, and again, it's above the president. The president's more of a, in my opinion, steers the nation. Of course, we know who makes the laws of the nation and who holds the purse of the nation. So you can blame whoever you want, but those two factors, those three factors, that's the amazing thing our forefathers did, was to give us a structure that was solid, everything in threes.
Well, because we're running out of time here, let me ask you, Theodore, do you subscribe to the idea of, this secretive group called the Illuminati?
Well, there is some good historical evidence that there are groups of that like that operate behind the scenes. I mean, do they have complete power? No, but have they, over long periods of time, and not just in our recent histories, had undue power? Yes. And I would like to thank the listener for his evangelical zeal. I share his religious sentiments, and I think that he hits on a very important virtue, which most world leaders forget, and that is the virtue of humility. And all the great religious traditions teach it, but most particularly Christianity. And therefore, I really think highly of his comment.
Well, I appreciate you hanging out with us for the last 2 hours, Theodore. And in the meantime, how can people get a hold of your book?
Well, I have so many books. I guess the best thing to go is on one of these websites that sells books and just look up Ted Malloch, M-A-L-L-O-C-H. There are books on business. There are books on practical wisdom. There are books on politics and economics. And the latest book coming out here in the next 60 days is The Plot to Destroy President Trump.
All right. We will look for that with great interest and anticipation. Theodore Roosevelt Malloch, thank you so much. Appreciate
it. Great being with you coast to coast.
Thank you. All righty. That is it. 4 hours have come and gone. For George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galante, Chris Burrows, Sean Latisore, Nathan Staten, and of course, Donna Walker. And here in Toronto, Mike Bendixson, Robert Turner, and Patrick O'Neill. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. This is Coast to Coast AM. So long for now.